Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. Glad you're with us again. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this week, the full hour with the Air Force's top acquisition official. Dr. William LaPlante is the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for acquisition. And when he was confirmed by the Senate this past February, one thing that was notable was that the position was finally being filled. It had been 2 years since there had been even an acting secretary for acquisition, and 5 years since the job had been filled by a Senate-confirmed appointee. LaPlante comes to the Pentagon as something of an outsider. He spent most of his career in academia at Johns Hopkins, where he researched national security technology issues, and at the MITRE Corporation. Now that he's in that Senate-confirmed post, he has five priorities for the Air Force. He talked about them with me in his Pentagon office in no particular order, but starting with the Air Force's need to keep its high-priority weapon systems acquisitions on track and on budget.
We have some big high-visibility programs that we have to get right. I mean, we judge ourselves, and the outside world will judge us on these programs, and they represent the critical capabilities for the future of the Air Force and the DoD, and I can just start rattling them off. They're all in different phases of acquisition. The big three that the Air Force has, of course, is F-35, KC-46A, which is the tanker, and then the next-generation bomber, which is also called the LRSB. Those three, each in their own way, represent the critical capabilities for, in some cases, for the next 50 years for the Air Force. They're all three in different phases of acquisition. The one that has been around the longest and probably the most well-known is the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter. That program is, compared to the past, in a relatively stable mode since about 2010 or 2011 when it was rebaselined. All eyes are on the IOC, the Air Force's IOC is scheduled to be about 2 years from now with the Block 3i software. The Marines are going to be the first of any of the services to IOC, and that's going to be next summer with 2B. So we're focused like a laser beam on making sure we get that IOC date met. The three areas in F-35 that we're all focused on, and this isn't just the Air Force, this is across the services are, number one, the mission software, number two, 3i is the one for IOC, number two is the reliability and maintainability of the airplanes that we have. We're now flying them enough to see where the issues are and to get them identified and get them addressed. These are what parts are failing more rapidly than we like. How can we make aircraft availability high? Just getting the reliability and maintainability addressed now is a big issue. The third area is the logistics IT support system that makes it all work, which is called ALICE. Those three are really what we spend every day focused on in the program. And again, the next 2 years are when we're going to be working towards getting an IOC for the Air Force. Cautiously optimistic, as Frank Kendall says, but we still have a good deal of work, even on the mission software, to be done. The second program, different phase, of course, is the KC-46A, the tanker. We're about ready in the next few months to do first flight. This is a 767 based on 767 commercial Boeing aircraft. We remain optimistic and that it's on schedule. It is a fixed price development contract, where the government's liability is capped at about $4.9 billion. Every month we have different issues, but we're still on track in that program. We're going to be at first flight within the next few months for what we call the green airplane. That is more just the air vehicle, but then the actual first tanker, where it's fully outfitted, including with the support equipment, will be about in less than a year. The third program is the LRSB, which is the details of it we keep pretty close held in terms of its classification, but we're in a competitive phase of that program. And the intent there is we're using cost per airplane as one of the critical KPPs, is essentially a requirement from the beginning, so it's being designed in. So if you have a concept, if one of the contractors has a concept that's going to be more expensive and is assessed so, it'll either be dismissed or lower ranked in the assessment of the competition. And that's the famous number of $550 million in fiscal year $10. 80 to 100 airplanes is what we're talking about eventually. And the philosophy there is design an adaptable approach where we put the first block, if you will, the first block that comes out, will be at the, you know, with the 80% of the capability, but we'll have the hooks, whether it's the open architectures, the interfaces, the hardening of the wings to upgrade and continue to have that bomber with us for decades to come. So those are the three prime programs that every day we're focused on getting them right. All three of them, as I described, have challenges in them, and all three of them represent critical future capabilities for the Air Force. But there's a few other programs that are also we're watching very carefully, either because of their visibility or the phase they're at. One is combat rescue helicopter. We have decided, even in these lean times, that's one of the rare programs that we're going to start, and we're about ready to award that contract in the next few weeks to Sikorsky. Another program that's we're working very hard on right now is beginning to spin up for the replacement of Air Force One. It's that time where the existing Air Force One planes are getting long in the tooth, and we have to begin the process of getting the next versions of those. There's also the trainer, the next generation trainer called TX. The existing trainers, the T-38s, are older than many of us here, and so they're wonderful airplanes, but we actually have to recapitalize those. So those are examples of programs that we're spending a lot of our effort on to get right. It's often been said that you set the course, the trajectory of a good acquisition at the beginning. You can screw up a good acquisition later, but you can't fix an acquisition that's been started the wrong way. You usually can't fix it. So that's why we've got a lot of attention on these new programs. So that's our first priority.
Let me just circle back on the acquisition programs.
Sure.
Broadly, when you look at all those together, your big priorities, and you want to stay focused on them, say a little bit more about what staying focused actually means. Does that mean they stay funded at the quantities you want, kind of to the exclusion of other things in the budget? How do you maintain your focus on that?
Well, so it's a great question. So I'll use the KC-46 as an example. Staying focused on it means, number one, we track progress on it, obviously the program officer is doing it on a daily basis. I'm doing it on a weekly basis. Myself and the Air Force leadership, including the Secretary and the Chief and Mr. Kendall, will be talks to the leadership, in this case of Boeing, every month. We're constantly passing information back. All eyes are on just literally the tracking of the program. Requirements, no changes to requirements. So we watch with an eagle eye any suggestions that somebody might change the requirements of that KC-46. Hasn't been any in the time I've been in the job, but we watch that very carefully. And then the funding. Every time we do a what-if drill, every time that we have to plan a budget that has perhaps sequester-type figures in it, we always ask ourselves the question and make sure the leadership understands, is anything put at jeopardy of those three programs? So for the KC-46, we have to continue to meet the government's obligations to that fixed price development contract. And so if we're doing budget drills, we will say, if we go to this budget level, the things that would be at risk would be this part of this program. And so making sure leadership knows where the lines are to protect those programs. And to date, and all three of those programs, F-35, LRSP, and the KC-46, we have successfully protected them, even in the most severe of the sequester scenarios. It's been very hard, but we have done so. So that's an example of what I mean by getting those right.
And everything you just pointed to brings up the issue of leadership visibility, high-level leadership visibility into all these programs. It's been pointed out many times that the job that you now hold was vacant for almost 2 years. This is a weird question to ask you since you weren't here when you weren't here, but do you have an assessment of the importance of having a Senate-confirmed official in the slot that you're in now?
Right. So it's actually been it's been almost 5 years. Sue Payton, who was the last confirmed Air Force acquisition executive, departed in March of, I think it was 2009. If I remove myself in the position from answering it and just try to look at generically, it's obviously incredibly important as a commitment to acquisition to have this position filled and have it filled by a confirmed Senate, regardless of whether it's it's me or somebody else. You know, it is the day-to-day acquisition leader for the Air Force. I work every day with Mr. Kendall. I work every day with my counterparts, for example, on F-35 with Sean Stackley. It's critical to have this position filled. We have great, great people in the acquisition workforce of the Air Force. I mean, it's one of the most pleasant surprises I've had since coming into this job is the incredible talent. And they do their job well, and they would do their job well, and we're doing their job well, whether this office is filled or not. It has a different importance, though. It has an importance in terms of coordinating, priorities, as I said, across services. Also, of attention to what is important. You need somebody in this job working with the leadership of the Air Force and the DoD to be having those hard conversations with our counterparts in industry. You know, that you need somebody in this position to do that. So there's lots of benefit to having the position filled and lots of not good things and not having it filled. I also think it sends a message, you know, whether intentional or not, that, naturally one would ask the question, if you don't have the position filled, you'd say, why not? Is it not a priority? If it is a priority and you can't fill it, then what is it about that means, you know, that we're missing here? Of course, those were all the questions I asked when they approached me, and I found out that thankfully, there's nothing but good here. It's a difficult position, and it's hard to find the right people who are in the right place in their career to take the job. But yeah, it's very important to have this job filled.
Dr. William LaPlante is the newly confirmed Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition. He'll be back with us to talk more about his five priorities for Air Force acquisition after our first break. This is on DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM, this is on DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest for the full hour is Dr. William LaPlante, who was confirmed in February as the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition. We're talking about his five priorities for Air Force acquisition, none of which he says are more important than any other. In our last segment, he told us the Air Force needs to do whatever it can to keep its most important major acquisitions on track. Just as important, he says, is creating a new degree of transparency and openness about those programs.
We have to do better at our communications. Our communications actually within the Air Force and within the acquisition community is pretty good. We talk to each other pretty well. We're very tight as to what's going on. It's very, very good comms. Where we're not so good and we're working on it is talking outside, explaining to the Hill and to our counterparts in OSD and to industry what's going well, what's not going well, and so that we are used to talking openly and we're all on the same page. I think there are really bright spots. An example is the KC-46. We were just talking about that. There is very clear understanding of where that program stands inside the Air Force, in OSD, and on the Hill. There's not any miscommunication there. That's a good example. In other areas, we're not so good at talking about it, and we need to explain it. So, for example, when we achieve savings in should cost, we have better buying power, explaining what that means, explaining what is a should cost saving and how to think about it. When we do a multi-year purchase or a block buy, explaining what the benefit is of that and the like. I think there we need to do, we're not as good, we don't do as good of a job. Also in the newer areas, I think instinctively people seem to be able to know what the differences between fifth and fourth generation aircraft are and air combat. We have a harder time explaining space situational awareness. You know, and why, what does it mean to have that? We also are still struggling in describing what electromagnetic spectrum and electronic warfare means. And then, of course, cyber. We're getting better at talking about cyber, but we still have a long ways to go. So I think transparency is something we need to work on. We also need to work on talking to people straight, not trying to sugarcoat things. What I told you is the three issues in F-35 are the three issues in F-35. I'm not sugarcoating it. People ask and they say, well, don't you have the helmet issue? No, we had the helmet issue last year. That's been pretty much solved. The issue we're worried about now is ALICE. So it's not trying to sugarcoat it, but trying to make sure that people recognize where the challenges are. When things are going well, we get the credit for where they're going well. So transparency is a second priority. And we, as part of that, we've actually begun an outreach with industry. We've done roundtables with CEOs and small business. We're actually collaborating right now with industry on a couple of initiatives to try to, we call it bending the cost curve, but really to tackle issues that all of us agree need to be tackled. For example, the process we go through from issuing an RFP, an RFI through contract award. How can we make it more efficient? How can we make it easier for companies to have visibility into it? How can we get better quality proposals? What can we do on the government side to remove some of the impediments that are there? Everybody agrees there's work to be done. We have a team right now across industry, Air Force team, working on that. So that's all part of transparency. The third priority is to implement those pieces of better buying power that are showing the most, the low-hanging fruit. We're doing all parts of better buying power, but some of them are really making much more of a difference right now for the Air Force than others. I mentioned earlier should cost. Should cost, which is really trying to understand and take the time to understand, both by us and our industry partners, what's the structure of our costs? What are we paying for? What does the market say we should be paying for these things, including the supply chain, the subcontractors, and taking the time to understand it collectively and get the best deal. Should cost is designed not only to get the best deal for the taxpayer, but to benefit everybody, including industry, by where those savings in should cost are found. They are pumped back into the portfolio that they came from. So if we did should cost savings, which we have in the space portfolio, that money and the savings on should cost, the first place it goes is back into other space programs. So that's a part of better buying power that seems to be really taking off in the Air Force. It's becoming internalized by the program managers. Another piece of that is let's not rush to get contracts awarded just because we want to get the contract awarded. If it takes another month or two to really sit down and roll up our sleeves with our industry counterparts, we'll do that. Another part of better buying power where we're showing a lot of, I think it's beginning to sink in, is affordability. Affordability, in the Webster's Dictionary term, can mean multiple things. What we're meaning in better buying power is before we start and set up a program and run its acquisition strategy, we make sure that within the budget, not just the 5-year budget, but if best we can, the 10 and 20-year budget, it fits within the portfolio of our likely funding profile, and that we don't start programs we can't finish. It's often cited that of all the programs that the DoD has started and canceled, and when you can add up the number, and it's a big number, and GAO does that. Well, one of the reasons that happens or has happened too often is we have started in the DoD programs that we never really were going to be able to afford. You know, the system pushes to get the thing started, get it in the budget, and then hope later that it will be funded and its rival program will not be.
And importantly, those costs are not just building the thing. It's the sustainment costs, which are much bigger, right?
Right. And you know, it's exactly right. And we are much better off being honest with ourselves at the very beginning and saying, we're not going to do this if we can't afford it. So we use the analogy of the college costs for your kid. You sit down with your son or daughter and you say, this is what the family can afford. If you can get us, it's up to this much a year. If you can get a scholarship, that's great, but this is what we can afford. It's that simple. And so we're doing that right now for the follow-on to Minuteman. What, no kidding, can the country afford for the follow-on to Minuteman? Not just in the development, but as you said, the sustainment. We are making those hard choices now so that we don't start something that we think cannot be afforded. There are other aspects of better buying power that we're implementing. Another one, which we have a lot of work to do, but there's a lot of power behind it, is more closely coupling the acquisition community with the requirements community. We in the DoD still have a long way to go there, but there's bright spots. The idea that we can go back and forth between us on the acquisition side and our colleagues on the requirements side, and really, no kidding, do the trades on what are you willing to really pay for? Would you pay for this extra capability? What means something to you? And as been said many times by people in acquisition and in requirements, that can't be a once or twice conversation. You may not be asking for what you really need. You may not really understand that. The person hearing what you're asking for may be hearing something different. That dialogue has to be persistent. And we have countless examples of when you have that persistent dialogue and an empowered team across requirements and acquisition, you can produce some really good stuff. On the other hand, if you just do it right at the beginning of the program, then we hear all the stories of 3 years later, oh my gosh, there's a requirement to do X. Sometimes that's called requirements creep. In fact, it's not. It's oftentimes the requirement hasn't changed. It took them 3 years to find out what it really meant. Oh my gosh, you said you wanted an availability of 80%. That sounded good to me. 3 years later, you say, oh my gosh, we've never had an aircraft with an availability of 80%. For me to do that, we'll have to achieve reliability that has never been achieved. You sure you still want that? Yeah, I told you 3 years ago, 80%. But you understand what that means? You know, and then you all of a sudden end up 3 years later saying, we need to rebuild the landing assembly because of this requirement. Well, is that a requirements creep? Not really. It's just you never really took the time at the beginning to go back and forth and understand what you were really asking for and what you agreed to. So that is a very, very powerful concept that we have to do much more to bring together. I know that the four stars in the Air Force are very enthusiastic about doing it. We have some great pilots that we've done that are promising, but we have a lot more work to do.
And what to you is the right venue to keep those communities linked? I mean, what's the forum for that?
My view is you have to obviously have the leadership support, but then once you get the leadership support, let's say it's an upgrade to the F-15. We just did this where it was some defensive systems for the F-15. Clearly, we have leadership support all the way to the Secretary and the Chief of the Air Force and the Chief and the four-star at ACC. But once that's set up, then on a weekly basis, at the action officer level, at the engineer level, at the analyst level between ACC and the program office, they're working on this they worked on it for 10 months, came back to us in leadership and showed us, if you're willing to pay this much money, here's what extra capability you had. And it was described in a way with analytics that the leadership could make an informed decision. But to get to that point took 10 months of weekly working together by this team on acquisition requirements. So it takes that kind of commitment. If we had just done the leadership meeting and then 10 months later said, okay, let's get the briefing on it, you would not have had that result. You had to put all that work in.
Before we move off of better buying power, you know, with regard to should cost and a lot of other aspects of BBP, there's a perception in industry that it's, at the end of the day, an attack on industry profits. I've heard people from OSD and others a million times say, no, it's not. What's your message on why it's not?
Yeah, it's not. I've heard the same thing. It's not because what I think we all say is that what we're trying to do, let's take should cost, for example. We need industry to make a profit. We need them to have a good business case to do what they're doing. We need them for the future. We need healthy competition between industry. You know, I worked closely with industry, but not in industry for my 28 years before I came to government. I always say that the best program offices to work for in the government when you're on the outside are strong program offices. Why? Well, first of all, they're easier to work with because they ask for the right, they manage you well. They don't micromanage you. But the other thing, and this gets back to industry and should cost, they also protect the programs. If a program is well run, it's going to survive. If industry and the government and the program office are doing good should cost analysis, pumping the savings back into other parts of that portfolio, still getting good profit, everybody's going to win because that program is going to survive. It's going to live. If, on the other hand, the program is having overruns, behind schedule, maybe profit might be high, but that's not a long-term sustainable activity.
That's Dr. William LaPlante, the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition. We'll come back after another break and talk more about his priorities. This is on DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. Back on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM, this is on DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Dr. William LaPlante is our guest. He's the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition. He's talking with us about his priorities for the Air Force after having assumed that role a few months back. He says the Air Force needs to do the best it can to protect its most important acquisition programs, even in the face of declining budgets, but that also means holding them to the costs they projected several years ago instead of letting them balloon out of control, and making sure the Air Force doesn't give the green light to any new programs before it understands what they'll cost in the long run. As one other step to rein in costs in the acquisition system, LaPlante says his service needs to place a premium on owning the data rights to the programs it's paying for.
As part of building up the strength of our program offices, we're emphasizing a concept of owning the technical baseline, and that is essentially having the program offices and the people that support them. It doesn't have to be all government people. Could be universities, could be FFRDCs. Basically being smart buyers, having the performance models of the system, having the understanding of how the legacy systems that it's replacing are performing in the field, being able to have data rights that make sense, so for future competition without taking away the secret sauce of industry. Owning the technical baseline is a concept that we're pushing out into program offices. Many people who've been around acquisition a long time will look at it and they'll say, "Oh, that's kind of what it used to be like when we had strong program offices." And to that I say, "Yeah, that's kind of what it means. It means, you know, make sure the government is a smart buyer." The fifth priority is we have to be building our systems, acquiring them, and upgrading them with an eye on the future, that some of which we're seeing today. Future which we know we're gonna be dealing with peer competitors, and I'm not even naming any countries that will have access and in some cases control of domains where we're used to just being dominant. We have to assume that people talk about space, that the United States is not the only country in space these days. Is it always going to be a benign environment that we don't have to worry about resiliency? Well, hopefully it will, but I wouldn't bet on it. Same thing with electromagnetic spectrum. Electronic warfare, jammers, they're proliferating worldwide. Some people call this contested areas, anti-access areas. But are we building our systems for the resilient adversaries and situations that we're almost certain to face in the future? We know we're going to face them. Let's build it in now. Let's build in the cyber resiliency. The cyber adversary only has to find the one window that's unlocked as opposed to going through the front door. So you have to understand where your vulnerabilities are, and we have to learn how to make our systems resilient.
That's a perfect point to pivot to the budget, because I know that the leadership, in order to pay for that S&T that you're going to need in the future, in order to pay for your future modernization programs, you've made some trade-offs to take some stuff out of the budget that you're paying for right now. The mood in Congress so far, at least this year, appears to be to reject a lot of those decisions. Can you talk a little bit about, what it means for your modernization program if you can't retire things like the A-10 and the U-2 and the other cost-saving plans that the Air Force has put forward?
Yeah, it's unfortunately, it's not that complicated when you look at it. So if you look at what monies that you have some control over, if you let's take a very simple example. Let's take military personnel costs off the table. We fence those off. Let's say that we fence off the key investment programs that we want to have to fund for our future. I mentioned the big three that we talk about: tanker, F-35, and LRSB. Once you start doing that, and then you remove options of retiring, for example, classes of airplanes, then anything else that's not in the categories I mentioned, all more stress is put on. That's why, as has been said by many, and you understand, I'm sure, the operations and sustainment accounts were hit so hard during sequester. It's because that was the place where one could quickly go and get fungible money, even though everybody knew in doing that we were killing readiness. It was because it was the Willie Sutton rule. It was where the money was and where you could get it fast. That's going to happen again as these choices are – every time a choice is taken away for the enterprise to prioritize, we can't touch this category of money. We have to fence that category of money. It just puts the bigger burden on what's left. And what's left? Readiness, operations and sustainment, and I would say smaller acquisition programs. So a program that tends to not get the visibility, I'll use – the upgrades to our legacy fighters. I mentioned earlier the F-15 defensive systems. Programs like that are put under tremendous stress when we're not able to make the choices that we are trying to make. It is our system of government. We recognize that. It's just that it's a math issue. If you don't increase the top line, in fact, the top line's been going down, if we go back to the BCA and we remove options for us to fit within that top line, what is left and not not been fenced is going to take the majority of the pressure. And that's going to be operations and sustainment, and it's going to be the investment accounts that are not in the protected category.
And the future S&T and research and engineering accounts, do you include that in that bucket that's at risk?
I do, with the following caveat that we are trying as best we can to do what we can to protect S&T. What I would say is last year, for example, by fencing the big programs and fencing the big three programs and fencing military personnel, even with the cuts to operations and maintenance and operations and sustainment, the investment accounts, that's RDT&E and procurement, took on average about a 20% cut. Okay. That was turned out to be about the average of S&T. S&T is a subcategory of RDT&E. Left by itself, the normal math pushed S&T to about a 20% cut last year. Well, with intervention, both within the Air Force and by OSD, we were able to, I think, bring the S&T cuts. They were much lower than I recall. It was down below 10%, I think, in the Air Force. So it takes intervention to protect S&T. I would argue, and I know others would, that it's exactly in times like these where we're drawing down, where we're trying to bring force structure down and prepare ourselves to build the future Air Force, is when we should be really betting and investing on our S&T, not just because it's our future in terms of innovation, but it's also how we keep the workforce, how we keep industry engaged, how we keep our industry teams involved. I'm also a strong believer in experimentation and as part of innovation, where you bring scientists and engineers together with the warfighter and you try existing capabilities in new ways or new, totally new technologies. This is when we need to be doing that. It all takes money. So the pressures are on the S&T budget, and we have to resist, and I view as part of my job to be a forceful advocate to protect that S&T budget and to do collaborations with other services and as well as with DARPA.
One of the criticisms Congress has taken through this process is that they're basically just trying to get through FY15 and not considering the impacts that these refusals to consider cost savings are going to have in the out years. I don't know if you've thought through exactly what that means to delay these tough decisions by 1 year, how much cost that adds, what the factors are that go into creating potentially that bow wave, as it's been called by some folks.
This year, of course, it's still playing out, so I haven't seen it close enough to give specific examples yet, but I can give examples from last year that are likely to play out again, maybe with different programs. An example is Space Fence. Space Fence was a program we were about ready to award last summer. That was right when the president's budget and what was going to be the effect of the sequester was all in play. It was before Ryan Murray. And the DOD, the Air Force was going to go ahead and award it, but the DOD, and the Air Force, of course, we worked with them on this, made the strategic decision that given the budget uncertainty, it was not clear where we were going to end up ultimately when the president's budget was going to be submitted, which ended up being last March. So new starts in Space Fence just happened to be a program that was a new start coming through at that time. It was getting back to this affordability thing. Are we going to be able to afford this program? We didn't know. We didn't know what the ultimate budget was going to be. Therefore, the decision was made, sensibly, let's hold off. Let's see if we can hold off making this award, see what happens through the fall. This was actually before the government shut down. So there was a lot of uncertainty at that time. What ended up happening, and we're about, is that we made it through the president's budget. Ryan Murray happened. We redid our priorities. We worked with OSD, and we're about ready to award the Space Fence contract. What happened, though, is we estimate it's probably going to cost about $70 million more, just the delay, because what we had to do is we had to restart the whole source selection. There was other work that had to be moved around, and it's going to give us the same capability a year later and will cost $70 million more. So delays can cost money. It's often been said that the enemy of acquisition of programs is change. We try our best to set programs up for the maximal efficiency of producing the product, minimizing the risk, and getting the right dollars. We consciously are doing it. We don't always do it, but it's our goal. We often do it. When that gets changed, when an outside factor comes in, We have to delay it because we don't know what the budget's going to be. I've almost never seen change to a program and end up costing less money.
Dr. William LaPlante is the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition. He'll be back with us for one more segment. We'll talk about service contracting after one final break. This is On DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Servin. Dr. William LaPlante, the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition, is our guest for the full hour. We've been talking mostly about the acquisition of products and his initiatives to get better value out of the dollars the Air Force puts on contract. We'll wrap up our conversation with a quick overview of the Air Force's efforts on service acquisition.
We've only got a few minutes left, yeah. And we're not going to do justice to service contracting in that time, but since it makes up actually a majority of the dollars put on contract, we should at least discuss it. The Air Force has gotten some credit for being first out of the gate for actually managing service contracts well, being the first to appoint a single manager for services. You guys have also announced that you're going to move to GSA's OASIS for at least the majority of your professional services. Talk broadly about where you see the Air Force's management of service contracting going in the coming months.
Yeah, I think, we like to think that we're leading the way on that. As you point out, services, from a dollar perspective, I think in the DoD last year, I think the number overall was like $185 billion in DoD services. It's a big, big deal. I think what you're going to see from the Air Force is more of those kinds of experiments and pilots. And to the extent of with OASIS, as we start to use that, it's a task order contract where the MAGCOMs in the Air Force, if they need a service, an AANS service, they can go to this contract, they can look at the portfolio of potential contractors that are in there, and they can buy task order, use that contract for what they're looking for. We're going to see how this is going to work. If it works the way we hope it will, we think it's a way that now I'm using service in a different way, the Navy and the Army, can also be going toward where we are able to tailor what is, what we buy in an economical way, that gets the best deal for the taxpayer. The other piece of services that we're working on, I mentioned earlier transparency as one of our priorities. We have to have more transparency in understanding what is going into our services funding. The coding for services is still, this isn't the DoD level, is still not good enough. We have a lot of codes, but they still, when you look in the system and you say, how much are we spending on knowledge-based services. You can get a number for knowledge-based services, but then you ask the next question, what's in knowledge-based services? And you find it's very hard to understand it. It's very bottoms up. We are working on making that much more transparent. I jokingly say knowledge-based services should be called stuff, because I think what can be contained in knowledge-based services is everything from a plasma physicist helping on reentry of the Minuteman missile to somebody, maybe doing a design of what your building is going to look like, somebody coming in and helping with a ViewGraph presentation, which is real work. We've got to get more precise in how we use it and how we classify it. So I'd say that there's more to follow. I think two years from now, you're going to see much more attention to our services, much more knowledge of our services, more experiments on how we do services. And I think it's been wisely recognized as a place that needs attention. The final thing I'll mention about services that makes it so different from everything else, a lot of the purchasing of services has not happened in the traditional acquisition world.
Right.
It happens at the working level of the commands. We saw it in the wars that, it was happening in theater by 19-year-olds. So it's very diverse. It's very bottoms up. And as a result, it requires a lot of our attention.
So let me tie together those last two points, both the transparency and the fact that this is sort of executed in a decentralized way.
Yes.
Once you get that transparency, is it time to go and go through and validate requirements and make sure these aren't things that are being purchased just because they're nice to have for a local command or somewhere?
Yeah, the obvious thing you look for are the nice to haves, but and I'm not dismissing that those aren't going to be there and we're going to find them. But I actually think we're going to find that's even going to be from a dollar perspective much more fruitful. It's going to be where we're going to find from disparities in what people pay, even geographically. What are we paying for IT services at our different bases, at our different parts of the, in different parts of the world even? And, you know, when it really comes down to, it comes down to, frankly, market research. We talk about should cost in services, and should cost is essentially about market research. What is reasonable and achievable to be able to pay for some of these services? It's no different than what we all do, you know, in our private lives where we know, you know, when we're taking our car in to get it repaired. We know what the dealer will charge. What is a should cost for getting our radiator repaired, and what's the dealer charge versus the other guy in your town? You do market research. We need to do market research, and we share it across the Air Force. And I think that's where really the fruit's going to be. Yes, we're going to find some things that are we shouldn't be buying that. But I think what we're going to find much more in terms of the dollars are going to be places where we're paying way too much, not out of any malice or any incompetence, but just not having the knowledge of what is achievable. So I think that's what you're going to see.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But Dr. LaPlante, it's been a really great hour. Thanks very much for giving us so much time.
It's great talking to you. Thank you.
Dr. William LaPlante is the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition. Relatively new on the job, the Senate confirmed him for the post back in February. He talked with us in his office at the Pentagon about his five priorities going forward. That's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Jared Serbib. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.